Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the great heroes of that war, as far as I'm concerned, for quite some time, is a friend and colleague of many years, now a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, among other things, a very profoundly impactful essayist and author and television personality, now based in Israel as a dual citizen. Her name is Carolyn Glick. She is, I think, one of the clearest thinkers and certainly one of the most articulate authors on the subject of the Middle East, our interests there, and the risks that we face in the free world, both Israel, the United States, and other parts, from the gathering storm that is shaping much of what's happening in that region and elsewhere. Carolyn, it is so good to have you back. Thank you for finding a few minutes to talk with us. It's been too long.
It's always great being on your program. Thanks for having me. And you truly are one of the great heroes of the war for the free world. So having you praise me that way is pretty amazing. Thank you.
A mutual admiration society, I think it's fair to say.
Listen, there you go.
Carolyn, you and I have talked off and on over the years about the existential threat to Israel that the Iranian regime represents, especially in the event that it obtains what is long sought, which are nuclear weapons, which might be delivered by ballistic missiles or other means, not unfortunately just to Israel, but perhaps elsewhere in the region or even here if they have their way. Talk a bit about where things stand now, as we've been told in the past month or two that these guys are within weeks of having sufficient highly enriched uranium to build bombs, and that's something Israel will not tolerate. Can you give us a read on where you think things stand at the moment?
So there are conflicting versions of the story, obviously, as you would expect. Israel's foreign minister and defense minister said around 2 months ago that Iran was about 2.5 months away from breakout nuclear capacity, which means that they have enough uranium stockpiled and other elements of nuclear weapons that they need in order to essentially assemble nuclear weapons whenever they want, so that they would be effectively a nuclear power who had simply not tested nuclear weapons publicly. So it's sort of like Japan, for instance. But now that time is gone and we haven't seen anything change. And then this week, the former head of the Mossad, Yossi Cohen, who was most responsible for Israel's war against Iran's nuclear program, its covert war for the past decade, said that Iran is a long way from being capable of building nuclear weapons because of all of the work that Israel has done over the past decade with the Mossad under his leadership and Israel under the leadership of now former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. But I think, either way, what was clear, I think, from both Cohen's statement and then from the statements later by Lapid and Gantz is that Iran is working assiduously to gain nuclear weapons. And the current Israeli government made a deal as soon as it came into office with the Biden administration, saying that it wasn't going to take any military actions or other actions against Iran's nuclear installations without American permission. And the Biden administration has made very clear that no permission will be forthcoming, because the Biden administration's Iran policy is to essentially allow Iran to become, at a minimum, a nuclear state in all but name. And practically speaking, it's hard to see them taking any action to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons, because they said even this week, the foreign minister was in Washington again talking about Iran's nuclear program and their rapid approach to military nuclear capacity. And again, he was brushed off by Blinken, by Sullivan, by Harris, by everybody that he met with. Essentially, all of them said, we're only interested in making a deal. And if we can't make a deal, as Rob Malley said, who's in charge of negotiating with Iran, then we'll make another deal. So Israel has come back, not surprisingly at all, empty-handed from Washington yet again, with the Biden administration yet again refusing to change their course, which places the United States on Iran's side against Israel and the Sunni Arab states that Iran is waging various forms of war against.
Yeah, let's come back to that. But Carolyn, you said something that's profoundly alarming, and honestly, I hadn't heard it before. And if it's so, I'm kind of surprised that it isn't more in the public domain. But Israel has, throughout its history, very clearly established the principle that it will provide for its own defense. And to varying degrees, it's benefited from help from others, including this country, of course. But the idea that the Israeli government, under any party, would tell the United States that it will only do something about an existential threat from Iran if the United States permits it to do so, approves it doing so. Well, that's a formula for, I think, not only the greatly diminished sovereignty of the state of Israel, but perhaps its very survival, especially given what you've said about the attitude that the Biden team is taking towards such a problem. Am I missing something here, or is there in fact essentially an American veto now for so vital a matter of Israeli security?
Yes, there's an American veto. Look, we have the most radical Israeli government we've ever had in charge now in Israel. I mean, it one of the partners in the governing coalition is the Muslim Brotherhood Party in Israel. This is something that is stunning, but this is what's happened in Israel. The coalition of parties that came together to oust Netanyahu has given essentially the balance of power to the Muslim Brotherhood. They came into office in June, and Yair Lapid, who is the real power broker in the government, he's the foreign minister, and he's going to take over as premier in 2 years. And he agreed with Blinken in Rome, where they met just days after the government was sworn in, that Israel wasn't going to surprise the United States in its actions on Iran. And as Netanyahu has said, and by the way, I've written about this a lot, it's too bad that it's not in the American media, but the implication of saying that you're not going to surprise the United States is that you're going to give the United States a heads up on all actions you take on Iran. And when you say you're going to give them a heads up, what you're saying is, we're going to wait for your approval. And in fact, shortly after they came into office, Israel took action against the centrifuges at the facility in Natanz, and they gave the United States an hour notice, and because they knew that the Americans wouldn't allow them to do it, and it was an operation that was already about to be done when the government changed. So Yossi Cohen was still in charge in the Mossad. And after that operation took place, we haven't heard of any further operations that Israel's undertaken in Iran. I mean, we never hear that Israel undertook an operation in Iran, except for the nuclear archive that was spirited out of Tehran in 2018. We only know about damage to the centrifuges, et cetera, from media reports. So we haven't seen any media reports indicating that there's been any significant damage in any of Iran's nuclear installations for the past 3 months.
And would you assess, Carolyn, as a close observer of all of this, with excellent sources inside the government and ministries, that the assessment of the former Mossad chief is right, that a lot of time has now been bought, and that the urgency of acting is if not dissipated completely, certainly has been deferred?
I don't know. I don't know. I can't imagine that Cohen would have said that if it weren't true. But on the other hand, it's really a question. And it's also a question of now when you see Iran enriching uranium to 60% purity, which is just a step away from weapons grade, and that they're doing it with advanced centrifuges. It's not clear how long it'll take for them to recoup their losses if Israel or other parties aren't taking actions to sabotage their nuclear installations. That is, they were able to go, you know, two steps forward, three steps back because of the sabotage. But if the sabotage has stopped and they're rushing forward to acquire breakout capacity with their nuclear program, it's not easy for me to understand what it means that Israel was able to delay it. Because if Israel was able to delay it significantly, but then Israel stops, then how long will it take for Iran to recoup its losses? And I'm certainly not in a position to know.
That brings me to this larger question, Carolyn. If we are going to persist in this reckless pursuit of some new agreement with the Iranians, that presumably, whether it's a deal in the first instance or a deal when that doesn't work out, that will be what they pursue in the second instance. I mean, this whole policy approach is so seriously flawed, reckless, and potentially fateful, certainly for Israel, and I believe for us, and certainly our friends in the region beyond Israel. When you look at what this administration is doing, is it possible to describe it as anything other than really a wrecking operation?
Yes. I mean, I think that the recklessness that you're seeing with the administration on matters large and small, what
we see
here
domestic.
Is I think that all of the gravest fears that we had about the Democrat Party and its radicalization and about what a Biden presidency would look like for the United States, for U.S. allies, for global security, are all being borne out in spades. I think that that's true. I think that we've seen lots of American administrations over the years make errors in judgment that harmed America, that harmed its allies.
Joe Biden
but you never
has
got
featured prominently in a number of them, either directly
in
the administration
and,
or from
you
the
know,
Hill.
I mean, it's what Winston Churchill said about America, that America always does the right thing after it's exhausted all other options. We rarely got the sense that the other options that were exhausted before America did the right thing were made out of malice or were made with ill intent towards America and its allies. Rather, that there was a very legitimate disagreement that people came together and tried to figure out the right thing to do, and they made the wrong decision. And here, you just don't see any Team B pushing a different option or even questioning what they did in Afghanistan, what they're doing towards China, Taiwan, what they're doing here in the region. So yeah, I think that there's a lot of call for deep-seated concern about where the Biden administration is going. And I can give you an example, which I think is very important, which is their madcap and horrible, horrific insistence on opening up a consulate in Israel's capital city, in Jerusalem, for the Palestinians who do not recognize Israel's right to exist and who openly and declare their intent to annihilate this country. So, I mean, this is an appalling thing. It's both contrary to American law, contrary to international law, that they're insisting on opening, without Israel's permission, a consulate in Israel's capital, where the United States has an embassy, to a hostile power. And this is the position that Tony Blinken set out angrily, obnoxiously, to Israel's foreign minister, Yair Lapid, while he was in Washington this week. This is something unheard of, and it's happening.
As a practical matter, can the United States do that in a sovereign state
of
Israel?
Not while following international law, because the Israeli government has to approve it, and two ministers have to approve it, the foreign ministry and the justice ministry. And the justice minister just said yesterday that under no circumstances would he approve it. So,
well, that's encouraging.
Biden will not receive although we'll have to see. But unless something changes, and it may, because, like I said, this is a very radical government, But unless something changes, he will not receive Israeli permission to do this. And it's unlawful under U.S. law as well for the United States to open up a consulate in a city where it already has an embassy. So,
well, especially
there are a whole bunch
when,
of laws, both international and American, that would be broken.
Yeah, but especially, as you say, Carolyn Glick, if the object of the exercise is to encourage the Palestinian enemies of Israel to be both bolder and more aggressive, it is just the height of folly, as well as malfeasant, for the United States to be doing that, especially against and over the objections of the host government. And I would like to think that the Congress of the United States, in which I served a long time ago when it was under the influence of people like my boss, Scoop Jackson, very unmistakably pro-Israel in character, that it would, you know, insist that the administration cease and desist such behavior. We have seen of late, alas, that the likes of Scoop Jackson no longer are in the Congress, and the people who are have made no secret of their hostility to the Jewish state. And this is, I know, of great concern to you as well, and it will be a topic for another conversation with you, if we may, as we're out of time for today. But Carolyn, thank you for sharing with us these insights and concerns. They should trouble every friend of freedom, American, Israeli, and those elsewhere in the world, because this is not going to end well if the Biden approach is persisting. And thank you for what you do to try to buck up both the people in your own country there in Israel, as well as the one from which you originally hailed. And we're so proud of you. And thank you for your work with the Center for Security Policy team as well, Caroline. It's deeply appreciated, and I know you'll keep it up. Come back to us soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I cannot tell you how excited I am by this next interview. This is going to be a conversation with a man that I've come to know a little bit and admire greatly, even before I actually met him. A man who I think epitomizes the best of our military warriors. A man who has distinguished himself in uniform as one of the most promising young officers, a man who suffered as a result of coming forward with unwelcome truths, particularly unwelcome by the Biden administration. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Lohmeyer, now a veteran of the United States Air Force. We're going to talk with him about why he is no longer serving as the commander of the Space Warning Wing, our squadron in the Air Force, why he is no longer in the uniform, for that matter, of the United States Air Force, and more broadly, what's going on here. And I've wanted to have this chat with him for a long time on our program, and it's extremely gratifying that we finally have him with us. And I want to say, first of all, Matt, thank you for your service to our country, both that you've done with distinction in the Air Force, and now that you're out, that you are rendering at a wonderful organization, the American Constitutional Rights Union, where you are now serving as the executive director of its important project entitled the Committee to Support and Defend. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. My friend, it's good to have you with us at last.
Frank, thanks for having me, and it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Let me ask you first, Matt, to talk a little bit about the insight that you had before you ran afoul of this administration into what was going on inside the military, how you came to discern extremism in the ranks, and what you tried to do about it.
Yeah, I had come into command of a space-based missile warning unit in Colorado now a year and a half ago, after coming out of what is largely considered the Defense Department's premier strategy school, SAS, the School of Advanced Air and Space Studies. And at SAS, we ended up deep diving Cold War history. And I had a personal pet project to better understand Marxist ideology and Marxist revolutions during that time at school. And what I was seeing unfold in the country writ large after the death of George Floyd, organizations like the Black Lives Matter movement, Antifa, etc., I recognized right away as a Marxist revolution that was underway. And even some of the co-founders of the Black Lives Matter movement admitted as much in their social media feeds. Malina Abdullah comes to mind. I think she's the chapter organizer in Los Angeles, who said, "This is the revolution," in May of last year. And as you're aware and your listeners are aware, Black Lives Matter is an admittedly avowed Marxist organization. And so the contact point between what I was seeing take place in the country and in the military was that, of course, our young service members will parrot what they're seeing in social media. Some of the what should rightly be considered extremist left-wing political ideology. And it was also being supported, unfortunately, by our senior military leaders from their own social media platforms, and even in some cases from officially produced Air Force and Space Force, in my case, and other services as well, essentially propaganda videos demonizing the character, the history of our own country. And so I saw that begin to unfold within the military. I used my chain of command to address it. I then filed a formal complaint with the Inspector General's Office of the Space Force to address it, all to no avail. And that's what led to me writing a book.
Talk a little bit about your book, Irresistible Revolution.
Yeah, so the intent going into the writing of the book was actually to trace through the lineage of Marxist ideas that led to our current social justice activist moment and movements, for example, which ends up in the end being part two of the book, the middle section of the book. But I also end up, without divulging the identities of our active duty service members, tracing through dozens of pages of actual real world examples from West Point to Annapolis to the Air Force Academy, and other bases across our military, of examples of this kind of left-wing social justice activism that was simply going unchecked. Senior leaders were disinterested, it seemed, in holding them accountable for their activism, all the while pretending to be very concerned about the, what in my view and many others view, non-existent threat of white supremacy, white nationalism within our ranks.
Which we are endlessly being propagandized is a very acute problem in the military today, as well as in the society more generally. And this brings me to the problems that you had with the Biden team on both the civilian side of the Defense Department and within your own service and other parts of the uniformed services. Matt, you were encouraged, in fact, the whole department was required by the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, shortly after he took office, to stand down to get a grip on this problem of extremism in the ranks. Tell us what you were being told was the purpose of that exercise.
You know, it's what's really interesting is historically, I was a fighter pilot for the Air Force before I came into the space community. Typically, when you do a stand down day, and they've been called that for a very long time, maybe someone has crashed and you've lost one of your fellow pilots. And so you're going to stand down to talk about safety and also to honor and remember your lost fellow pilot. And we treated this extremism down day, is what it was called, earlier this year, as an even more serious kind of a threat that we faced in our armed forces than any of the other former reasons I've ever executed a down day for. And this isn't something we do frequently, have a down day. I mean, these are few and far between. There have been a handful of them in my career that have, especially ones that have been department-wide. But Secretary Austin came into office and as a part of his own confirmation hearings and videos that service members were seeing shortly thereafter, he was making it very clear that it was his view that white supremacy within our ranks is one of the greatest threats that we face as a military. It really left a lot of our service members scratching their heads. And shortly thereafter, it was, I think, the 5th of February, he issued a memorandum to all commanders throughout all branches of the military, directing that stand down be accomplished by a particular day, about a month and a half later. And so me and every other commander throughout the Defense Department executed that down day. Now, we had some general guidelines that we were supposed to follow. For example, we were supposed to talk about the importance of our oath to defend the Constitution. Well, that's a pretty easy thing to address. But what's interesting about the directive that we received was the context in which the conversation was supposed to appear. There were training manuals that were distributed to all of these commanders. And page one of the training manual that we received in the Air Force and Space Force began with, on January 6th, 2021, we essentially saw white supremacy on display at the nation's capital. And now let's have a conversation about dangerous extremist ideologies. And then they provided specific examples in the training manuals for our commanders to follow and pull talking points from years past, odd, one-off kind of extremist examples that they could find essentially what you could say is the history books. And they treated 2020 as if it never existed at all. All the ravaging of our streets and private residences, small businesses from Black Lives Matter and Antifa, none of that was mentioned at all in the 40-page training document that I was to take my cues from, because that's not the threat to civil liberty and the peace of civil society. It's the white man. And, you know, I'll tell you, that didn't just make white men uncomfortable. It made nearly every service member that I interfaced with on this issue uncomfortable, regardless of their race, regardless of their political affiliation, because they recognized that even if not overtly, they implicitly sense that this is a highly politically partisan and politicizing issue that the Defense Department was pushing from Secretary Austin. And a number of my service members came to me privately and said, I don't think we should be talking about this at all. I said, I think you're absolutely right. This is the politicization of our armed forces. And so many of the service members were very grateful when they heard that I was both writing a, you know, there were only a handful that heard I was writing a book, but that I had filed a complaint about the politicization of our military. And they were really grateful to hear that someone was actually speaking up who was in uniform, because they feel powerless, these service members. I mean, largest, most important group of citizens in our country who feel like they don't have a voice is our people in uniform.
In fact, they don't really have a voice except through, you know, veterans like yourself, you know, the occasional elected representative who will stand up for them. And, you know, a few of others of us who are very committed to the idea that they must be given a voice, especially on matters like this. And I just wanted to wrap this part of the story up, Matt, because it's so telling. You essentially responded to the call to root out extremism by pointing out that there was abundant extremism in the ranks. Only, it reminds me of that line from Star Wars, these aren't the droids you're looking for. You know, you were pointing out the Marxist extremism in the ranks and the real threat that it represents to, well, the institution of the military and its ability to do its mission, vital national security mission. But that wasn't what people like Lloyd Austin and this fellow Bishop Garrison, who is his I don't know, racist training czar, his counter-extremism chairman of this working group. This is really alarming. And what I'd like to do in the remaining couple of minutes we have with you today, Matt, is just very quickly walk through some of the techniques that are being used by Marxists like, well, Garrison for one, and members in uniform of the military who I think have, if not actually thrown in with it as a matter of ideology, or at least going along to get along. Talk a little bit about things like, well, this CRT training itself, for example, you've discussed it a little bit, but the indoctrination's impact on the good order and discipline of the military when it turns, you know, comrades against each other.
Right. You know, whereas a year and a half ago, service members didn't walk the halls looking with a skeptical eye at one another, the very outcome of divisive, Marxist-rooted, critical race theory-based diversity, equity, and inclusion trainings is precisely that. It's divisive intentionally, and it causes people to be skeptical of one another. I've resisted the idea for a for a long time that everything we see playing out in American society is a part of a grand plan. And anymore, the way things are lining up in this country, any number of policy decisions which seem to your typical American citizen or service member, for that matter, to be utterly idiotic, foolhardy errands, our terrible open border destroy America border policy right now, that's totally hypocritical. I mean, we're imposing on our Marines standards that we're not willing to impose upon people who aren't members, who are legally entering the country. We're not going to deploy our Marines worldwide anymore because they're not willing. Some of them, only a few of them, really, hundreds, aren't willing to get the COVID vaccine. But we're willing to deploy illegals all throughout our own country who haven't been vaccinated. So you look at all of that and you say, that is the stupidest kind of policy decision. Well, it makes a lot more sense when you start to understand, in fact, there is a plan. There's a plan to destroy this country, and people both wittingly and unwittingly are participants in that plan. And it just so happens the current administration is both very wittingly and unwittingly participating in that plan. Anymore, I'm thinking it's entirely wittingly. There are people you have to come to grips with the fact. We have to come to grips with the fact as American citizens that there are plenty of people now within our own country, and there have been for a very long time, in fact, that hate this country. They do not want America to survive in its intended form, and start to look at these issues through that lens and ask yourself if all of the blunders that you see taking place don't make a whole lot more sense. And so, yeah, there are tactics being employed, imposed upon our active duty service member that are Marxist in origin. I mean, I trace in my book, for example, in one of the italicized vignettes in the very opening of, I think it's chapter 5, about how in the Korean War, Chinese communist captors were extorting false confessions from its American prisoners, because it does something to the psyche and morale of the human to constantly be confessing your guilt. We're doing the same for diversity, equity, and inclusion trainings by insisting on the guilt of people who aren't guilty and then extorting those confessions of guilt. Over time, what you're doing is absolutely undermining the trust that our service members have in their senior leaders. You're undermining good order and discipline. You're destroying morale. And even if it only infects, you know, a part of the population, it will wreck the morale of our armed forces. And you're going to run into people leaving the services, and you're going to have some recruitment issues as well, as people decide, do I really want to sign up for that? And what we're starting is no.
And not least, what you're going to get are people who are recruited who may not be fit, or who may not be the kinds of people you want in uniform. Maybe they'll follow these orders. Maybe they'll do faithfully their part in the wrecking operation, as I call it, clearly the Marxists inside the Biden administration and their friends on Capitol Hill and elsewhere seek to have played. And Matt, I just want to salute you for your clarity on the nature of this problem, your courage in bringing it to all of our attention, and your efforts, both before you went into the final throes of your time in uniform and now that you've taken it off, to actually do something about the mortal peril that our country faces if it does not stand up and resist what is being done to, well, unmake, yes, the military, for sure, to use your phrase, but also to unmake America itself. We have to leave it at that for the moment, my friend. I'm going to be having a conversation with you shortly that will air this weekend on our television program, Securing America, on the Real America's Voice. I'm very excited to have a chance to further visit with you about all of this, and look forward to many conversations in the future with us, if you will indulge me. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Thank you for this really important book, Irresistible Revolution, The Marxist Goal of Conquest and the Unmaking of the American Military. I urge everyone to get it, read it, pass it along to your friends. It's It's truly required reading. Matt, thank you for your time again. God bless you, my friend. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Johnny Vance about an effort to teach freedom.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined for the first time by a Hollywood talent by the name of Johnny Vance. He is the writer-director of a new animated video series entitled Tuttle Twins. It's a very exciting project, crowd fundraised for the series in an unprecedented scale, I think some $3 million, to create an animated kids show that would be a vehicle for teaching children who are otherwise all too often deprived of any information about freedom, its importance, and this wonderful country that has given so many of us so much of it for so long, is indeed desperately needed. And I'm delighted to have a chance to talk with the creative force behind Tuttle Twins and share with you how you can find out more about this exciting product. Johnny Vance, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's good to have a chance to visit with you about this venture, and congratulations on getting it off the ground.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is a topic that I'm excited to hear about, you know, sort of your ingenious approach to addressing the problem. We talk about the problem a lot here, not surprisingly, namely the fact that fewer and fewer of our kids are being taught, exposed to even, the fundamentals of this country and the values that its Constitution enshrines. Talk a little bit about why that is in America today.
Yeah, you know, Frank, we've seen, and I'm sure your audience has seen, just how rampant this anti-freedom, Marxism, all of these agendas are in today's society. Kids are being bombarded at every level. And what can parents do? How can we make freedom seem cooler than communism, or at least more abundant in the minds of our kids? You know, they're being attacked in the classroom. They're being bombarded in kids' shows, right? So it's a very ubiquitous problem.
Would you say that is? I mean, you've obviously given a lot of thought to this. It's not an accident, comrade, is it? That this is so much the norm these days, whether it's in academic circles or the pop culture or the media more generally, the books that they have in their libraries or, you know, that are on offer at the schools. What is creating this dominant alternative narrative to the one that is traditionally pro-American, pro-freedom, and has, you know, made this country what it is today, or has been?
You know, I think a lot of us are scratching our heads at that. I think there's a few factors. One of them being communism always seems like the new idea. Freedom seems like an old idea. But if you look historically, freedom is very much a new idea. It's the American experiment. And it's worked so wonderfully. And I think that there's just been a narrative shift. I also think, for much of the time, Hollywood has been anti-freedom in a way, in their messaging. And if you look at Hollywood as an industry, it's not the biggest industry. It's far smaller than big tech. But it is the most influential industry. And I think it has a disproportional amount of influence on our kids and our families, on society as a whole.
Yeah. Especially over time. I don't think there's any doubt about that. The culture has driven politics, as Andrew Breitbart pointed out. It's upstream from politics. And it has created certain dynamics that reinforce sort of the effort to, march through the institutions, as the cultural Marxists like to say, notably academia. So you're trying to address this in a creative and very appealing format of an animated video series Tell us about the Tuttle Twins show and how you, you know, try to make sure that these children of America are, in fact, at least getting some exposure to the historical, traditional narratives of our country.
Absolutely. Yeah, so the Tuttle Twins show, it's a show about a grandma that moves in with her two grandchildren and their family, and she takes them on adventures in her wheelchair time machine. And so we get a chance to really go back to these amazing historical figures. Like you were saying, explore principles, you know, that America was founded on, principles of free speech, principles of personal freedoms, the golden rule, free market economics, everything that's being breezed over or completely omitted in today's classrooms. And we do that in a very fun way. And that's the goal of the show. It's to make not only freedom and economics fun, but make it entertaining and marry those two together and make it something that kids want to share. Make it cooler than communism. And that's the goal. We want to reach 100 million kids with this show. It's a big goal, but we think with the help of viewers, like on this program, that will be possible.
Well, and maybe before we get to that and how people can help, talk a little bit about the extraordinary response that you got to your crowdsource fundraising efforts to get this program built in the first place. And it speaks to an appetite, I think, among Americans for this kind of programming that's I have to say, heartening when you're confronted seemingly day by day by the evidence of, if not actual, you know, throwing in with the radical left's view, at least an acquiescence to its increasing dominance.
Absolutely. So I just wanted to quote a study really fast, and then I'll get right into that. A recent study from a national organization, and it's escaping me right now, said that 63% of American adults want family-friendly content. 40% are willing to fund it. There are so many people that want content that reflects their views about the founding of America and these views of freedom. And so we based this show on a book series of the same name, the Tuttle Twins book series. They'd sold 3 million books. And we were as anxious as anyone to know, how is this going to be received? We need the only way to make this show. Hollywood's not going to make it. We need to crowdfund it from parents who believe in it. And so when we put it out there, we were incredibly amazed at the backlash it got, first and foremost. Had lots of haters coming out of the woodwork, but of the support and people putting their money where their mouth is and funding something they wanted their family to see. And earlier this year, we finished our crowdfunding raise. We raised almost $4 million. We became the world's number one crowdfunded kid show ever. And so if that doesn't speak to, you know, to just the power that the American parents have and
as I say, freedom, the perception that they have that there is a yawning need for this kind of programming. And, you know, interestingly, we're, of course, in the midst of a debate about the appearance of some of these parents at school board meetings, notably here in the Washington, D.C. area and Loudoun and Fairfax County's school boards. And it's been incredibly moving to see these parents decrying what they're finding out their kids are being force-fed in the way of, well, I call it communist racist training. CRT is, of course, the acronym. But the point is, whatever you call it, it is deeply hostile to freedom and to, you know, I think everything that this country stands for. It is, in fact, a sort of Marxist indoctrination. And what you're saying is that people were willing to put their money where their mouths are, and that almost certainly translates into an audience for this kind of programming. So tell us quickly about the programs and, how many of them are available and how can people find them?
Great. So it's available through a free app We want to get this message out as far and wide as possible. And to do that, we keep the app free through people who generously pay it forward and support the show. But you can download the free app, Angel app. Just go to angel.com. You can download it on any of your devices. The first episode has already been launched, and we'll be releasing several more episodes before the end of the year, covering topics like what makes a just law, the free market, the golden rule, and how to you know, have a peaceful society, entrepreneurship, inflation, and the dangers there. So lots of fun stuff coming. You can join every Tuesday until the end of the year, and we'll have great things in the app. But it's that's where you can find it.
Now, when you talk about the golden rule and you talk about the free market, these are not necessarily topics that one would think would be appetizing to, you know, viewers raised on, I don't know, SpongeBob and the like. How do you, and again, we're talking with Johnny Vance, who is the writer director of the Tuttle Twins show. So you've been intimately involved in the creative part of this and figuring out how to make it, as you say, exciting and fun and so on. Can you give us a quick insight into the secret sauce that allows you to take some of these topics that might not seem obviously engaging in that way and yet become so as a result of your animation?
Yeah, perfect. I'll give you an example. I don't want to spoil too much, but in the episode about the, you know, invisible hand and free markets, the twins go on this adventure to an ice cream land. And they learn from two competing ice cream tribes, the ice creamers and the children of the cone, just, you know, how much better society can be with free trade. And so that's just one example of how we're able to take complex, you know, lessons, distill them down into a world that kids like. We also meet Adam Smith in the episode and have some fun with him. So
you really bring these really just about individuals, whether they're founding fathers or whether they're iconic figures like Adam Smith, to life in a way that the kids can relate to and be engaged by. I think that's a very cool idea and a challenge, especially at a moment when we're incessantly being told that these are dead white men and, you know, the kind of people you should pay no attention to, if not actually revile, right?
that's absolutely right. We're highlighting the best of these men that are being erased in today's classrooms.
Yeah. Well, let's come back to the pushback, because presumably you're going to find, as the product is beginning to make the rounds and becomes hopefully very widely available through presumably, you know, crowd sharing as well as crowdfunding. Do you anticipate that you'll be taking flack from, you know, these teachers who are all about essentially indoctrinating and brainwashing even their students to believe that none of this is true, and if anything, it's misinformation of the kind that children must be shielded from. How do you anticipate you'll deal with that kind of phenomenon?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's not if, it's when, and it's already happening. We're getting lots of pushback to start, and I'm sure it will only grow. The beauty
describe
of
what
our
it
platform
looks like. I mean, is it silencing you? Is it just, you know, denouncing what you're doing or trying to make it harder to get access to the product? I mean, what kind of pushback are you experiencing?
Yeah, it's been denouncing us so far. It's been trolling in the comments. It's been trying to look up past things about you know, each of the members of the creation team and try and cancel us. But the nice part is, with the format of our distribution model, we own the distribution with Angel Studios. And so it's very hard to cancel something that's not mainstream or that's not traditional. And so we'll obviously not back down. We're going to continue to release these messages. We want to empower parents. And then when we do get backlash, we handle them as respectfully as possible, but stand our ground. And that's been our strategy. And so we will see what comes, but we're ready for it.
Well, I want to commend you for both the idea behind Tuttle Twins show and for the obviously innovative approach that you've taken to bring it to life, avoiding studios, avoiding, you know, typical funding sources, avoiding the corporate tyranny that can be used to try to crush any of these sorts of things when the left makes up its mind that it must be canceled. And I'm sure, as you say, you're going to be facing more of that. But more power to you, I think. And my guess is, and hope certainly would be, that not only will this particular show vindicate the vision that you've brought to bear, Johnny Vance and your team, but also that you will be able to go back to those folks who have made this possible with their crowdsource fundraising to put on a lot more programming that will be addressing in an even bigger way the challenges that we're currently facing as a country. Challenges to freedom, challenges to the Constitution that guarantees our freedom, and challenges to the nation itself, I think, which is, of course, a national security concern, as well as of the utmost importance from a public policy point of view. So let me just say thank you on behalf of myself and the Secure Freedom Radio audience, and Godspeed. And just close us out by reminding us exactly how people can go about getting access to Tuttle Twins' show and making sure that they can share it with, as you say, their communist friends, among others.
Absolutely. Thank you, Frank. I, as you were saying that, I wanted to also give credit to our showrunner, Daniel Harmon, who couldn't make it today, and also to Angel Studios for that innovative model of being able to crowdfund and go out of Hollywood. So viewers, listeners, you can find the Tuttle Twin show for free at angel.com. Just download the app there, and we'll be releasing content weekly until the end of the year.
Great. And the first installment is now available for free. Is that right?
It is.
Great. Okay. Johnny Vance, keep us posted on your progress, would you? And as I say, Godspeed. Very proud of what you're doing and excited to see its future success, which I think is virtually assured, especially if folks like our audience get behind it. We'll talk with you again soon. We'll talk with the rest of you, I hope, again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Effney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.